back a half century now to remember my grade school days, which means that far more has gone out of my head than has stayed in, but there are some memories that still remain especially vivid. The fire alarm bell would sound its gongs in a particular sequence, not the same ones that we got for a fire drill. And the teacher would say in all solemnity, "That's the signal for an air raid drill." We knew what to do, little 7, 8, 9 year olds that we were, which was to walk out of the room in single file, line up against the hallway wall, kneel down on the floor, curl ourselves up into little balls with our hands folded up over our heads. I also remember that the hall lights, for whatever reason, were turned out. So we had to do this in the dark. And we had to stay that way until the principal had walked through the whole school to check to see if the drill had been properly carried out, after which another series of gongs would go off, and that was our signal to get up and go back to our classroom and to resume our so-called normal activities. In our grade school minds, as you can maybe imagine, this was a rather strange thing to do. We understood fire drills. We knew that a good sized fire, we understood fire drills, we had to go outside, we knew what fire was, we knew that a good sized fire could burn down the school, which was not an altogether bad thing in our grade school minds, so long as we were not in the building. Fire drills were kind of cool, actually. You got to go outdoors. And there always was, as I say, the possibility that this was the real deal. And if the building really was on fire, we would get to go home for the rest of the day. We couldn't see much further beyond that as to what the consequence of not having a school to go to would actually be. But of course, we were just little kids bored with school. And anything that got us out of there for a while was certainly okay with us. But the air raid drills were something else. We figured they had to be important. Outside of our homes, the most immediate and visible authority figures in our lives were the teachers, our teachers, and the principal. And if they said we had to squinch our little bodies up against a cinder block wall in a darkened hallway, there had to be some reason for it. And we had to be given a reason, so we were told that these drills were because of these people. Well, they were people of a sort, actually, but they weren't really people like us. People called Russians. And these Russians were more often than not also called communists. And these Russian communists were bad, evil people. Bad and evil mainly because they didn't believe in God, which was about as bad and evil a thing as you could do or not do at that time. For the first several years of my life, in fact, I thought the phrase "godless communist" was all one word because I never heard one term used without the other. And these godless communists who lived in this far-off country called Russia had these atomic, or maybe it was hydrogen bombs, they wanted to drop on us and kill us all off, so they could turn America into another godless communist country just like their own. And that was why we had to curl up against a wall in the hallway. Why doing that made us any less vulnerable or any more safe should an atomic or hydrogen bomb be dropped on St. Albans, West Virginia, was never fully explained, and we never asked. I just remember the specter of fear that hung over those air raid drills was in marked contrast to the almost festive spirit that a fire drill brought out. The latter held out the prospect of liberation from our schoolwork and our teachers and the principal. The former meant we could all die. Truth to tell, we didn't do air raid drills very often, maybe once a year. Our teachers and even the principal were actually quite benevolent folk who I have every belief were not into deliberately scaring little kids. And they had their orders, after all, from the school board or wherever they were coming from, that we had to do this, and they were just carrying it out. But infrequent as they were, the impact of these drills was indelible and long-lasting. If there was a reassuring counterpoint to them, however, it was going to church on Sunday, as practically everybody in my neighborhood did. And hearing that we were under the protection of God, and singing, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." And I don't believe it was ever said in so many words, but there was an implication given, nonetheless, that Jesus, if not God, was somehow an American. Or at least Jesus would have been an American, had there been an American in his day. So what we had was the specter of godless communist bombs being dropped on us on the one hand, being offset with the idea of a God who especially favored our country on the other and would not let such a thing happen to us, so long, that is, as we believed in him and obeyed his word. The way to offset the fear of communism then was to be as God-fearing a person as one could possibly be. Until recently, recent months and years, I mean here, these kind of memories had more or less been boxed up and stashed away in a box somewhere in the cluttered attic of my mind, to the point that I'd almost forgotten about. A lot of other stuff's happened to me in the ensuing 50 years, after all. But some things are taking them out of their boxes now and bringing them back. Bringing them back rather vividly. Maybe it's because the phrase Islamic terrorist has become a one word in our cultural lingo, not unlike that of godless communism. Maybe it's because, as the lead article in last Sunday's New York Times magazine well illustrated, we have a president who truly believes, as he seeks to do battle with Islamic terrorism, that his every action, tactic, and maneuver is indicative of his doing the work and will of God. For the record, I think it is primarily a good thing that those who lead this nation at any level of leadership be persons of faith. It is when that faith leads to a largely unreflective and uncritical certainty as to how they exercise that leadership that I get a little, well, fearful. I'm also getting ahead of myself. My pre-election sermon is next Sunday. I want to stick as best I can to the topic of fear this morning and how it plays itself out in our personal and civic lives. It was just a little over 3 years ago that we had our vulnerability as a nation, as a people, horribly exposed in a way we could have scarcely imagined up until then. If we did not know so already, we were made aware that there are persons and powers in this world who really don't like us, really hate us, and who will act on that hatred in whatever, with whatever means they have at their disposal. They may have their reasons for their feelings towards us, some of them more substantive and reality-based than others, but they strike at us with what they see as divinely sanctioned ease, and would be convinced of the absolute moral correctness of their deeds. This is indeed fearful. Question seems to be then is how does one, on both the personal and societal level, deal with the reality of fear without being defined by it? Now, those of you who have been listening to me offer my sermons up here over the years are probably thinking, okay, now here's where he says, in order to get a better perspective on this issue, let's take a couple of steps back and get a running start on it. All right. Just so you won't be disappointed or second guessed, in order to get a better perspective on this issue, let's take a couple of steps back and get a running start on it. You hang around for too long and you start to wonder about these things. Anyway. Fear in and of itself is not a bad thing. Possessing the capacity to know and experience fear is almost as essential to our survival as eating and drinking and breathing. Back when I was learning to fear communist bombs, I was also learning to be afraid, if you will, of cars going down a busy street. Don't walk out in front of them. or of strangers who might wish to do me harm.
Don't talk to them or go out with them.
Or of things that could hurt me.
You don't play with sharp knives or fire, for instance.
Anyone who has ever raised a child will tell you that one of the most scary times, or ongoing series of scary times, in that process is when the developing child does not know enough to be afraid of certain things that he or she would do well to be afraid of. One of the many balancing acts, which I know a number of you can relate to, one of the many balancing acts of childbearing is wanting one's offspring to have a trusting attitude towards his or her world and to feel safe and accepted and at home in that world, while also learning how to avoid or confront, if need be, all that is harmful or even deadly out there. It was over 25 years ago that Dr. Willard Daly, a psychiatrist and a medical ethicist, published a little book called Feelings that remains a part of my personal canon of truth. In this work, Galen points out how many of the feelings and attitudes that we generally tend to regard as negative, things like fear and anger and guilt and shame and the like, Galen's point of this whole book is to point out how those kinds of things also have a positive dimension and serve a positive purpose when it comes to our physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual survival and well-being. It was their capacity for fear and anxiety that served to warn our earliest human ancestors that they were in danger. It was their capacity for fear and anxiety that they had to have this. If our earlier Homo sapiens type felt no fear at the approach of a lion or a tiger or a bear, he or she wasn't much longer in this world. If they had that capacity, we probably would not have shown up somewhere down the evolutionary chain here. I think it is a sound contention on the part of a number of social scientists and anthropologists that our earliest human ancestors organized themselves in families and in tribes and societies and cultures and civilizations largely on the basis of an underlying anxiety over how well they felt they could survive or not if they were just on their own and left to their own devices, especially in a world that they often felt mystified and overwhelmed by. Along with that process, when those early ancestors also became aware of how much harm human beings could inflict upon one another in at least as deadly a manner as lions, tigers, and bears, this was another factor that I think led to their forming tribes, cultures, nations, and civilizations. You know, part of what was going on in that process was that human beings would band together for protection against the shadow side of humanity itself. It probably went something like, well, we here amongst ourselves will guarantee the safety of one another against whatever they may be up to out there. And while that process was inevitable from an evolutionary perspective, it has given us situations time and again in the course of human history where what might be called a rational level of anxiety or concern or even fear within a given society can very quickly and easily move to the level of hatred and distrust and to an irrational fear of anyone or group of persons who look, think, act, or believe differently from the perceived norm. This, in fact, is the paradox of fear that I think we human beings have had to live with throughout our history. Paradox is that fear both protects us and it dehumanizes us. It brings out our best and it brings out our worst as human beings. Now let's bring that paradox back to the era where I began this sermon. Yes, there really was a Soviet Union with Russia as its largest component country. And yes, it was driven and ruled by an ideology that was largely antithetical to the values and principles of Western liberal democracies. And yes, this communist-ruled Soviet Union did have the capacity to destroy us, just as we had the capacity to destroy it. And yes, this was a force in the world we rightly needed to confront with prudent national defense measures and by our vigorous competition in the world marketplace of ideas as to how nations should best govern and care for themselves. Our response to this quite rational cause for anxiety, however, was in large measure to capitulate to an irrational and destructive form of fear called McCarthyism. And Joseph McCarthy alone could not have done what he did had there not been a climate of fear accessible and available to him. So in the name of defeating communism, which was a worthy objective in and of itself, jobs were lost, careers were ruined, reputations of decent, loyal Americans were savaged, and a couple of hapless spies named Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were sent to their deaths, all in the name of somehow making us feel safer and less fearful. And little kids cowered in the darkened hallways of their schools. And undergirding it all was a self-glorifying kind of religiosity that supposedly lent a divine sanction to all these endeavors. The fact that Senator McCarthy himself went down to dishonor and disgrace, I believe it was in 1954, did not diminish all that much the aura of fear itself. That aura was still strong enough, even as we move into the 1960s, to cause us to send, again in the name of destroying communism, nearly 60,000 Americans to their deaths in a poor and far-off country, one smaller in size than many of the states in our nation, called Vietnam. This country's actual threat to us was anything but demonstrated. But there was an enemy we feared, and we had to go fight that enemy. Somewhere. Anywhere. The names of those near 60,000 Americans now etched on a black granite wall, located not very far from the halls of power where the decisions were made that sent them to their deaths. And the very fact that the meaning and legacy of that war has been a hot and divisive issue in this current presidential campaign means, among many other things, that those seeds of fear that were sown 15 years ago continue to yield a caustically bitter fruit that we still taste to this day. Speaking of the present day, here we are. I can only point to a few things now that I will be expanding upon a week from now. As strongly noted and acknowledged earlier, there are persons and forces in this world who are repulsed by our values and our way of life, who in fact hate them to the point of wanting to destroy us as a nation and a people. They don't really have the means to actually do that, but they have managed to inflict enough pain, shock, and death upon us to make us quite fearful. Fear of terrorism itself, I don't think, is irrational any more than combating it is irrational. Where we go, where we had gone with such fear is another matter, however. Once again, we've gotten war. Fighting a country whose threat to us has been anything but demonstrated. But there was an enemy we feared, and we had to go fight that enemy somewhere, anywhere. And once again, in large measure, God has become an American. This fear is costing us on the home front as well. A year and a half ago, Mark Turkowitz, he's the media editor for the Boston Globe, wrote a piece in the Globe magazine entitled "The Death of Dissent." Here's just a few lines from it. A number of factors have virtually silenced America's culture of dissent. One central element is a tidal wave of public opinion, forced by both anger and fear, supporting the goals of defeating terrorism. The administration has used that mandate to convey a message that dissent is, if not downright un-American, at least dangerous. The policy questions raised by the war on terrorism require a public debate. The big question is, will we get one? Well, there have been some changes in the national climate since this article was written about a year and a half ago. But Mr. Jerkowitz's essential point and his questions remain valid. While the two major candidates for president have their marked and meaningful differences on how to deal with terrorism in general and the Iraqi war in particular, this campaign hasn't really given us the kind of debate
Jerkowitz calls for. A tidal wave of public opinion, forged by both anger and fear, to which he refers, continues to roll. And the candidates, each in his own way, ride that wave. But at some point, in the very near future, a conversation is going to have to take place, and this question is going to have to be seriously dealt with. How do we as a nation come to truly understand our image, our role, and our right and meaningful place in the community of nations, given our status, given our power, and given the ways in which we live out, or fail to live out, the values and ideals we profess? For all the volume of words that have been spoken over the last several months, I don't know that too many have really been specifically and openly and honestly directed towards that question, and I don't expect that conversation to take place over the next week. But at least one question, one question to take to the polls with you a week from Tuesday is, who do you think is best equipped to foster and engender that kind of conversation once the next presidential inaugural has taken place this coming January? I'll pick up on this as well as a few other threads next Sunday. And as I prepare that sermon, I will be bearing in mind some words by our Unitarian Universalist Association's president, Reverend William Sinkford, in a pastoral letter he recently published on the website of the UUA, Unitarian Universalist Association. I recommend it if you want to go there and read the whole thing. I'm just going to close with a few words from that letter today. Dear friends, as Americans, there is more that unites us than divides us, and there can be but one common destiny for this nation. So let us stand purposefully on the side of love. The message of fear has been trumpeted throughout this election season. The message of love is quieter, but it is the antidote to that fear. Let us do what we can to make this quieter message heard. And let us all do our part to bless and make whole a country wounded by partisan conflict and weary of division. In the spirit of Reverend Sinkford's words, I invite you to sing together, closing hymn, number 131, Love Will Guide Us.